Welcome to Candid Catholic Convos, a program brought to you by the Catholic Diocese of Harrisburg. Our mission is to humanize the Church and help you to grow in your faith, love, and understanding. I'm your host, Rachel Trochet, a cradle Catholic who's only human and struggled with faith on more than one occasion. Each week, you'll hear engaging, down-to-earth interviews and actionable strategies you can implement into your life with ease to help you grow closer to God. If you're ready to open your heart and step fully into the person God created you to be, then you're in the right place. Let's get started.
Hello, happy St. Patrick's Day. Welcome to another episode of Candid Catholic Convos. Few Catholic saints are as celebrated in the secular world as St. Patrick, the patron saint of Ireland. Everything turns green, and those who may not be Irish in heritage become Irish at heart, celebrating the lore, leprechauns, and luck associated with the holiday. St. Patrick truly is the man, the myth, and the legend. So much so that some even forget he's a saint, and why that title was bestowed upon him. So what makes him so memorable? Father Brommer, pastor of the Cathedral Parish of St. Patrick here in Harrisburg and director of our Office of Divine Worship, joins me today to unpack what's truth, what's fiction, and how this legendary saint became the patron of our diocese. Father Brommer, thank you so much for joining me on Candid Catholic Convos. It's been a little while since we've had you on the podcast, so I'm excited to have you back.
I'm so happy to be back with you. Thank you very much.
So let's talk about St. Patrick, the man, the myth, and the legend, because he's all things and he's a saint. So let's talk a little bit about him as a man. What's his backstory and kind of what led him to becoming who we know him as today?
I think you framed that correctly. The man, the myth, and the legend. And most of what we know is legend. Most of what has been handed on from generation to generation is legend. But historians tell us that there are 10 facts that we absolutely know are true of this man that we call Patrick. One is he was an old man when he wrote his autobiography, The Confession. And when he wrote that, his Latin was not very good. So he's very unskilled in Latin. The second, that his father was named Copernicus, and he was a deacon of the church. His grandfather was named Potitus, and he was a presbyter or a priest of the church and a councilman in his village in Britain. We know, number four, that Patrick, at the age of 16, was kidnapped by pirates, taken to Ireland. Number five, that his faith was kindled while he was in captivity. Number six, that he worked as a shepherd while in captivity. And it's during that time that his life had this major shift. He heard the voice of God talking to him. Seven, after 6 years, somehow he was able to escape by stowing away in a ship. And he got out of Ireland and traveled for 3 days until he reached the land. Number eight, after a harsh time with no food, Patrick and his companions found a herd of pigs. Always a welcome sight when you're hungry, I guess. And they ate honey from the hives that they discovered. So he lived off the land for a little while. Number nine, he visited his parents in Britain just a few years after he escaped. And number 10, he claims to have baptized thousands of people in Ireland. So they're pretty good facts. Those those 10 basic facts that historians give us that are true of this man who lived somewhere between 420, we're not sure his exact birth date, and he died somewhere around 490. Once again, we're not sure of the year, but he lived a long life and certainly had a major impact on the culture and the religious life of Ireland because of what he did. So we have to sometimes sort through the history and what we call in the church the hagiography. You will notice I didn't mention anything about a shamrock. I didn't mention anything about snakes. And I didn't even mention anything about a mountain fast. I mean, they're the stories that most of us have grown up hearing about Patrick. But those are things that probably have some root in a historical fact and then were expanded little by little. Patrick lived during a time that the Roman Empire was drastically declining. He lives in what the historian Peter Brown calls late antiquity. So he's on the far outreaches of the Roman Empire. They didn't think they could go any further than where they were in Britain. And then all of a sudden, he's taken even further from Britain to the very edge of the world, he thought, which was the coast of Ireland that he was in. He didn't imagine that there was anything else that could have been further away from the center of all that was Rome and all that was the civilization at that time. So he lived very much on the outskirts, probably was like a upper middle class kind of kid growing up, which is why he probably didn't practice his faith so well. there's, I guess, a little pressure of being a preacher man's son, you know? So you had both his dad as a deacon and his grandfather as a priest, and that would have been a little bit of a pressure on him. But his faith didn't seem to really take root until he had that dramatic experience while he was in captivity. That's an interesting little story. Maybe we could just pivot right into that,
yeah,
into the captivity story. So marauders, barbarians invaded, and they took him captive. He was about 16 years old when that happened. They would have taken him because he would have been cheap labor. Now, this was not an unusual thing in the culture of the time, and it certainly wasn't an unusual thing where he was living. Lots of people experienced the horrors of this enslavement by barbarian folks who were coming into their land, and it was especially true of the Irish. Being on that island, they would come to the mainland, take as much as they could back, which included human people. Human beings that they could use to work and to do all of the sort of menial labor. The Irish didn't want to have to work at this time. So those pagans or those tribal folk thought it was a sign of wealth to be able to do nothing. And so having slaves was a benefit to them. So Patrick's enslavement wasn't unusual, but it certainly was unfortunate for him in some ways, but also a mixed blessing for the church at large. So as a 16-year-old, he was vigorous, able to do lots of things. They made him a shepherd. So he was out tending the flocks. And it's during that time, in the quiet, in the silence of being alone and being alone with the animals, that God did his magic in his heart. He called him from the depth of his heart to realize that he could have faith. And he awakened in him the faith that probably had originally been placed in him by his family. And so that faith became alive, and it became a source of strength throughout the time of his captivity. But it didn't mean he was going to stay there. So he's happy that he had this opportunity to get out of Ireland when he saw the chance to stow away on a ship. So he stows away, ends up in the mainland. And this is where everything gets a little foggy. We know that he had to forage for a little bit for his food, as I said at the beginning, but somehow, after going back to visit his parents, he has another experience. And this is one of the experiences he recounts in his biography, The Confession. He says he hears the voice of the Irish calling him back. And so in the midst of this freedom that he had fought to be able to have again, he realized he had to go back to the land of his captivity. And he had to bring something with him, and that was Christ. So somehow he got himself ordained a priest or a bishop. And we think a bishop somehow. So the rules back then probably weren't as strict as they are now. We know they weren't. And so he got himself ordained a bishop, probably by someone who was in modern day France. And he goes back as a kind of missionary and maverick kind of bishop on his own and goes back to Ireland. And he begins to bring the faith to the people of Ireland. And it's that is Patrick's greatest gift, because he responded to that call of God and he gave himself over completely to that.
He lived like an entire lifetime in those 6 years, if you think, even just leading up to captivity and then after that. And it really just shaped everything after that, which is just kind of remarkable. And it's, God is a God of surprises. Like, I'm sure that at 16, he wasn't like, you know, oh, you know what I want to do? It's like you said, it's a lot of pressure. You know, coming from a family that has religious ties and almost being expected to. I remember when I was 16, anything that my parents told me, I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. And now that I'm much older, it's, oh, I get it now. It makes sense.
Absolutely. It's heartening, I think, for parents out there. They don't realize how much is actually sticking.
Yes.
When it comes to the faith and when it comes to those fundamental values that we try to hand on with our Catholic Christian life. And so we have to have some confidence that in the midst of what we're doing to hand on the faith to the next generation, more is getting in than sometimes we're always aware of. And it's not our task alone to make sure that this happens. God has his way of doing what he needs to do in that person's soul. And it can be most surprising, as you said. Our God is a God of surprising. Listen to what Patrick says. This is just a quote from his autobiography. When he was out tending the sheep, he says, "And there the Lord opened my mind to an awareness of my unbelief, in order that, even so late, I might remember my transgressions and turn with all my heart to the Lord my God, who had regard for my insignificance and pitied my youth and ignorance. And he watched over me before I knew him, and before I learned sense or even distinguished between good and evil, and he protected me and consoled me as a father would his son." That's a pretty profound insight
that he has.
And it smacks of the prodigal son.
Yes.
You hear that whole thing, that sort of my misspent youth. But it also is this beautiful confession in the abiding love and the tenacity of God. And he's able to admit that. We're in about the same time as St. Augustine's autobiography. And his is called, Augustine calls his autobiography The Confessions. This is just called Confession. So I think that there's some similarity there.
I was going to say, do you think one influenced the other?
Definitely. I think that there's a strong impact at this time, that there's drawing out of this kind of literature that is a prolonged exposition of the heart and the mistakes of the past, but an awareness of how God is at work in the heart is connecting both of those amazing men. And their confessions still have an impact on the church to today.
So I want to get back to something that you kind of touched on earlier about how St. Patrick is largely a man of myth and legend. You mentioned the snakes and the shamrocks. And according to the legend, St. Patrick chased the snakes into the sea after they'd been attacking him during his 40-day fast. And I read that he's credited with a miracle for this, although, like you said, I don't know exactly how much truth there is to that. Is this more of a metaphor, you think, for the pagan beliefs that were widely held in Ireland and his kind of banishing those as he spread the word of God?
I think definitely it's a metaphor or an allegory for driving out the sort of pagan snakes that were in there that were afflicting the people and causing harm. There's certainly a connection all the way back to the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses takes the seraph serpent and puts it on a staff and holds it up, and the people find healing from that. So there's this conquering snakes is something that's part of biblical literature. It's part of our biblical tradition all the way back to the very first snake that appears in the Garden of Eden. So we have these serpents who are often the sign of evil. And the evil one. And in this case, I think the evil was the lack of faith and the pernicious desire not to have the Christian faith. Patrick experienced a lot of pressure, especially from what we would perhaps today call the Druid priesthood or the Druid sorcerers who were around there. And he was often the victim or attempted victim of attempts against his life. And he saw that lack of faith and the false faith that was sort of being handed on by these pagans as a danger to everyone. And so his most important aspect is that he is an evangelizer, and he was bringing the truth of Christ and the truth of Christ's way to the Irish people, and they little by little embraced it. It's one of the great movements of how Christianity spread so strongly and carefully throughout a culture, throughout a people. And it was a little tricky in Ireland because what the structure of the life at that time was tribal or clannish. And so you had these tribal leaders or these clan leaders who were rival to some extent when it was necessary to be rivals. But they were also at times kind of confederated. And there's usually one that rose up as the chief among all of the chieftains, the head tribal leader. And so Patrick was able to convince the head tribal leader that the faith was real. And that comes through a miracle that is often attributed to Patrick, and I like to believe is true, but it probably has a little bit of legend mixed into it as well, that there was a great pagan feast happening. And the pagan feast coincided with the period of the Easter Vigil into Easter Sunday. And so we know our tradition today. And so it's a little bit of an interpolation into the past. But the story goes, and this story is beautifully pictured in the cathedral stained glass window in our St. Patrick's Cathedral in Harrisburg, that the evening of the Easter Vigil, when Catholics throughout the land light and bless fire, they were forbidden from lighting fire because it coincided that year with a Druid feast. where the fire had to sort of be originated with wherever the Druids, the priesthood was affecting this fire. And so no one was allowed to have any light. No fire was allowed in the land. And once it was sort of born anew into the at the Druid's hands, then it was spread throughout the land. And so there was a bonfire spread little by little. Well, Patrick, being obstinate, or shall we say being faithful to Christ and the way of the church, did not follow this, and he lit a fire that night. He lit the Easter fire. And this fire, of course, in a land filled with utter darkness before any light pollution, caught the attention of those who were in charge. And so he was called before the tribal leader, the chieftain, and told to give an account. And it's there in that opportunity he had before the tribal leader that he was able to convince the chieftain of the truth of Christian faith and began to move the faith very, very generously throughout the Irish people. So that courage that he had in doing what he knew was right and he had to do came through the miracle of fire that was the true miracle in opposition to those who were of the pagan faith there.
That's really fascinating. And I absolutely love that stained glass window at the cathedral. It's just truly remarkable. So if you haven't had a chance to go see it yet, make a visit to the cathedral and make sure you check it out. So then the theory of the shamrock, is that how, like, the theory goes is that that's how he explained the Trinity to those who didn't believe. Is that rooted at all in truth anywhere?
Well, it's rooted in the fact that he was able to proclaim and teach the Catholic Christian faith to those who were unable to do that. And did he use natural images? Yeah, I think he probably grasped at every available image or every story that he could connect with. That's what a good missionary and evangelist does, even to today. So he certainly would have used aspects of nature, because the Irish were a very nature-oriented religious people. So they were used to all of those sort of naturalistic images and things. Did he use the shamrock? We're not quite sure that actually happened. But it doesn't mean what he was doing wasn't an
it's
authentic
not outside
expression.
Of the realm of possibility.
Yeah, it's possible, but it's probably unlikely that he picked up a three-leaf clover and held that up for everybody to be able to see that. But it's part of the hagiography or the legends that surround the greatness of this man. And all of that, though maybe not factual, and we have this with so many of the saints, expresses the truth of what they were striving to do and what they were able to accomplish. So the fact that the shamrock has become so emblematic of Patrick and his desire to proclaim the triune God, it means he was successful in what he did. And so if it becomes the sign of that or the metaphor of what he did, I think it's brilliant. It's true to me. So
I love that. It speaks to how resourceful he must have had to be to be able to do what he did throughout the whole country of Ireland.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about St. Patrick as the saint. His feast day is March 17th. Why do we celebrate him on that day? And was his feast day solely acknowledged in Ireland for a time, or has it always been a kind of worldwide observance?
Yeah, it definitely wasn't a worldwide observance until closer probably to the 20th century.
Oh, wow.
So I think that Patrick definitely had an impact wherever the Irish went. And that's really the story of that. The reason it's March 17th is because that's the traditional date that is given for his death. And so often the heavenly birth or birthday of a saint is the day of their death. Mm-hmm. So St. Francis of Assisi died the night of October 3rd into the 4th. And because it was already sundown, they consider his feast to be the 4th. And so we've celebrated Francis of Assisi on October 4th. So Patrick died on the 17th, according to what we are able to know. And so that's been his traditional date ever since that. But the Irish had such a love for Patrick, and there are other saints as well. I mean, there's a strong love for their saints in Ireland, especially the other monastic saints, that wherever the Irish went, they brought their devotion to Patrick and to the other Irish saints. And so that's really the history of Patrick spreading throughout the world. Wherever the Irish are, Patrick is. So that's the history of really why in Harrisburg, we have a church called St. Patrick Cathedral. St. Patrick's Cathedral was originally founded as a Christian community in the Harrisburg area in the early 1800s. And in that time, there was an influx of Irish workers into the city of Harrisburg. There were laborers who were in many ways were working along the canal and working with whatever needed to be done. They had emigrated to the United States and they were spreading throughout the different states, especially on the East Coast. And so we know that though there were missionaries in the early 1800s to Harrisburg, what really sort of solidified the community was the Irish came and sort of set up roots. And so their original chapel was actually built where Sylvan Heights is. And we used to have our orphanage out there. And Bishop Daly, when he was ordained a bishop for the diocese, that was auxiliary bishop, that's where he lived for a period of time. And so that was property that the diocese had. And then they purchased land down in the city itself, and they moved closer to the city. And so in 1824, they were able to purchase some land on State Street, and the first St. Patrick Church was built on State Street and the cornerstone laid in 1826. That is what we consider our birth date as a parish. So the parish was sort of brought into its life in 1826, and we're nearing our bicentennial.
That's wild.
So we're gearing up for that at the Cathedral Parish to celebrate St. Patrick and all of that as well. So those laborers continue to bring the faith, live the faith, and celebrate the faith. And the church that is there today, which is the second St. Patrick's Church on that location, is a testament to the fact that all the way from Ireland, they still bring the love of Patrick. And he continues to inspire and to influence us to this day.
That makes so much sense, because around that time is when we started getting an influx of immigrants coming to the land of opportunity. Like, I know my grandparents are first generation American, so they came from Italy and from Ireland and from Norway. And I just find it fascinating that Harrisburg was where a lot of the Irish settled, because this area has such Germanic and Dutch influences. Like, we have the whole Pennsylvania Dutch community. How did St. Patrick then become the patron of our diocese, given the melting pot, essentially, of cultural influences we have?
So you'll remember that the diocese was founded in March of 1868. And I think a lot of the reason St. Patrick became the principal patron of the Diocese of Harrisburg has to do with the fact of the location of the original St. Patrick Church and the fact that the first bishop was Irish as well, right?
That so, makes sense.
The first several bishops were Irish. So when you start with a Shanahan and you go to a McGovern and then you have a Shanahan, we have a deeply rooted Irish sort of episcopacy here in the Diocese of Harrisburg. That certainly had something to do with it. Could they have chosen another church? Absolutely. But in the erection of the diocese on that March day in 1868, the Holy Father would have consulted, and they would have designated that St. Patrick probably was the best place for that. And so Bishop Jeremiah Shanahan affirmed that. The original St. Patrick Church became the proto-cathedral. And so it became the pro-cathedral that was the original anticipated cathedral, and that was where all of the celebrations of the faith for the diocese would have been experienced, with the diocesan bishop in the term of the first two and a half bishops, let's say, because it was the third Shanahan. John Shanahan was the brother of Jeremiah, who built the current cathedral.
Oh, wow.
Began the process in 1904 with consultation of the clergy, and it was a synodal process that was happening. And so they decided there was a need for a larger and a more fitting space for the diocesan church. And they tore down brick by brick all of the other church and rebuilt it in Burnham, which is in another part of the diocese, in the western part of the diocese. And it was there for generations until I think the 1980s it might have burned down or something structurally happened with that. But they built up this new St. Patrick's Cathedral that was completed in 1907. And so the Irish who claimed to have, you know, saved civilization in that book, that famous book, certainly were such a huge impact in the Catholic life of this diocese. And so they continue to be in so many ways. And so many people either claim Irish heritage, or at least on St. Patrick's Day, pretend to have Irish heritage, but the Irish have preserved the faith in so many ways for generations.
That's so true. And And speaking of going back to St. Patrick's Day, a lot of people who maybe aren't Catholic or aren't Irish, like you mentioned, celebrate this as well. And it's usually with an overabundance of green and leprechauns and excessive alcohol intake. How do they marry the two, the celebration, the over excess and St. Patrick, when it doesn't seem like they would really go together?
They don't go together in so many ways. In fact, the Irish in Ireland do not party like the Americans who are Irish seem to celebrate
in heart or in heritage.
No, it's a religious feast day in Ireland, and so the intention of things is not to get drunk, but to get filled with grace and to open yourself up to grace and to ask Patrick's intercession. So one of the things that's so novel about the American way of celebrating St. Patrick's Day is the excess. But that seems to be an American sort of trait at times. We like to overdo things. And that's not something that you would experience in Ireland. I had the privilege of being in Ireland for St. Patrick's Day about 20 years ago now. And the people who were celebrating and sort of excessively celebrating were not the Irish. It was it was an influx of visitors and travelers to Dublin that were having all of the fun. The Irish weren't marking the day in the same way we do. So it doesn't make sense. It also doesn't make sense because St. Patrick's Day so frequently falls during the Lenten season.
Exactly.
And so how can you reconcile those two extremes? Now, Americans easily find it as a day of feasting over the fasting. But in Ireland, the legend of Patrick, and especially the Irish saints, is one that is rooted in penitential practice.
We've unfortunately run out of time, but if you'd like to hear the rest of this episode, you can listen to us anytime on Spotify under Candid Catholic Convos, or you can download this episode from our website at hbgdiocese.org.
Thank you so much for listening. Our goal at the Diocese of Harrisburg is to walk with you on your faith journey. So if this episode resonated with you in any way, the easiest way to show your appreciation is by sharing this program with your network or by leaving a review on your listening platform. You can also support us financially by making a donation online at hbgdiocese.org/DAC and clicking the Make a Donation button. Thanks again, and we'll see you at church on Sunday.